Broadcasting from Manhattan Beach and the World Wide Web, you're listening to CHSR, HealthyLife.net.
As a service to our listeners, this program is for general information and entertainment purposes only. CHSRHealthyLife.net does not recommend, endorse, or object to the views, products, or topics expressed or discussed by show hosts or their guests. We suggest you always consult with your own personal, medical, financial, or legal advisor.
Welcome. You're listening to Way of the Dreamer with Robert Moss. This is where we affirm the value of dreaming, coincidence, and imagination. I have a wonderful guest today. His name is Tom Cheatham. I've been reading him for 22 years when he produced a biography, a book about Henri Corbin, the great French scholar, Iranologist, student of medieval Sufi philosophy. And Tom's book told me in detail how Corbin was drawn into this because somebody, a French scholar called Massignon, gave him the sole copy of a lithograph of a huge text by Surawadi, the Sheikh al-Ishraq, the teacher of the light. Anyway, Tom shares my passion for these people, Surawadi, Ibn Arabi, other great Sufi philosophers, one of whose contributions to our collective thinking is that they brought us the idea of the imaginal realm. I'm going to get Tom to talk about that. The imaginal realm, a realm between the worlds of time and eternity, where great teachers are available, where things that are beyond form begin to take form that can manifest in the world, and so on. Tom Cheatham, biologist, philosopher, poet, author of 5 books on the imagination, psychology, religion, and a book of poetry. He taught natural science and humanities at college level for 2 decades. He's a fellow of the excellent Temenos Academy, and he teaches and lectures online and in person. He has an interesting Substack with a great title, As Variously as Possible. Welcome, Tom.
Welcome. Thanks very much. That was a delightful introduction.
Thank you. Well, I mentioned how I learned from you how Corbin was drawn to Surawadi and this whole Alam al-Mital imaginal stuff. What first drew you to him and to them? Do you remember? Can you talk about that?
Oh, yeah, I can absolutely remember. It was via James Hillman, because at the time, back in 1990, the summer of 1990, I just happened across a book by Hillman. It was actually Tom Moore's book of collections of Hillman's writings called A Blue Fire. And I picked it up on a bookstore shelf because I liked the title. And I didn't start reading it for a while. I was at the time being a biologist and feeling pretty scientific. But when I got back home with that book, I eventually picked it up, and I just fell in love with Hillman's work. And the reason for that was that it seemed to solve a problem that I had at the time that I didn't even know I had, and which I have to say I still sort of have today. The problem is how to reconcile science with the humanities, if you want to put it that way, or rationality with spirituality. And Hillman's solution, as I read it then, was simply to put imagination at the center of everything. And that just thrilled me. And then, I read Hillman's work pretty passionately for a couple of years, until I hit his essay, The Thought of the Heart. And on the first couple pages of that, he says, well, if you really want to know about the imagination, then the person you have to know about is Henri Corbin. And that was probably in 1992 or so. So without going on at great length, I'll say I got a copy of Korban's book on Ibn Arabi, and I started to read it, and I thought, well, wait a minute, this is about the Quran and angels and the Bible, and I don't do this. This is crazy stuff. And at the same time, I was just deeply moved by it in some peculiar way. So for quite a long time, I was alternately repelled and attracted by Korban's work, and I just couldn't put it down. And that was the beginning of a very long tale.
So Tillman played the role for you of Monsignor, the French scholar who'd come back from Tehran with a copy of Surawadi's work in Arabic, I believe, and hands it to Korban and says, I think this has something in it for you. So Hillman essentially said to you, Korban has something for you, go find it. I like your quest to bring science and vision, direct experience together. I have long thought, not being a particularly scientific orientation, but wanting to validate and justify things in today's terms, I've often thought that the idea of state-specific science is very relevant here. What is the kind of science that is state-specific in the sense that is directly relevant to what you're trying to understand? You know, as a dream worker and dream explorer, I know that I don't want to hear too much from scientists who can tell me about the neurology of the sleeping brain. I'm interested in that. I don't throw it away. I want scientists of dreaming who can travel inside the dream world and do things inside it and talk about that. And actually, a great scholar of these things with the wicked name of Dement, William C. Dement, Western dream research for the previous generation, he said the same thing. We want research inside the dream world. So when it comes to imagination, yes, concepts of the imagination are great. I'm going to get you to give us your ideas about how to define and explain imagination in general terms. But I want to go there. I mean, I'm with Mark Twain when I think about these things. I want to hear about the moon from someone who hasn't been there. And the great beauty and great compulsion for me in the people that Korban was reading and writing about, Ibn Arabi and Surawadi, is these are travelers. I mean, they leave no doubt. I know about this. I know about Orkalia and Jabasa and these imaginal realms because I have been there. You say you doubt. Well, listen to those who've come and gone as travelers. And that's the great element that I like. They're not just conceptualizing and they're not just quoting the Quran. Although they do quote the Quran, I'll slow down. I'll just throw this one thing at you, Tom, before I draw breath and get more of your wisdom. I was looking at a simple line from the Quran this morning. Enter houses by their doors. It's in the second surah of the Quran. Enter houses by their doors. When we read the Meccan openings, I mean, Ibn Arabi's magnum opus, it's a very important line because it's about opening the doors to the real world of imagination, to the palaces of wisdom, to the teachers who are available. So there we are. There's the Quran. Enter houses by their doors. So let me ask you to inform us, educate us, arouse us by talking about two words or two phrases. The first is imagination. How do you explain the imagination? And the second is imaginal realm and the imaginal itself.
Oh, boy. You know, it's complicated.
Okay. Every relationship is. Every good conversation is likely to become so.
Before I even address that question, what I'll say is that the reason that I've stayed with Korban and the issue he raises for so long is that it feels like every time I try to answer one of these questions, I'm having that experience of beginner's mind, you know? Because every time you come at this material and explore it, even just a little bit, it shifts under your feet, you know? So the next time you come at it, you're in a slightly different place, and you see slightly different things. And so I think one of the characteristics of talking about the imagination, the imaginal world, is that it's a shifting landscape that shifts with you. And Corbett was pretty good at explaining why that happens. And so see, if you come to this material with a the kind of standard rationalist mindset that Blake was so annoyed about that he saw in Newton. And that's quite common, I think, these days. I certainly had it myself for most of my life. If you approach these questions as if they could be answered in any definitive way, that's not going to be very helpful. On the other hand, it makes the job of explaining these things exceedingly difficult, because you have to first establish the ground rules that you really don't know what you're talking about. No, that's not what I mean.
Well, I hear you, and so does Augustine. You probably remember Saint Augustine said, "If you don't ask me what time is, I know. If you ask me, I can't explain it." It's a problem of explication that's peculiar to you. I'm not going to let you off the hook, but in order to get you back on it, I'm just going to say a couple of wild things to you, based on my own reading, not just of Corbin, but around. Even Arabian characters like that. Even Arabi's talked about the Barzakh, remember, the isthmus, could be another term for the imaginal realm, the slippery, because you kept saying slippery, slippery, slithery realm between time and eternity, slippery realm, the isthmus. And he also said it's the particular hangout and residence of the jinn, you know, the genies, jinn, who can be good, bad, or different, but for Corbin, they're often elements, fixed elements that conveil reality from us. So Ibn Arabi, I'm not sure how much Corbin features this, but Ibn Arabi, particularly as Bill Chittick explicates it, writes a great deal about the role of the jinn in this realm, and the jinn are slippery. One of the ways, according to Islamic dream interpretation, of knowing whether dream or vision is for real is whether the image will stay put when you look at it, or whether it slides away, in which case it's of the jinn. It's of the jinn, who aren't necessarily evil, but they're not to be trusted. They're slippery. They won't stay in place. You know, they come and go. So just as I listened to you, I thought, oh, God, we're in the realm, perhaps, in terms of, you know, the Islamic mind. In Islam, as you probably know, you have to believe in the jinn, or you're an infidel. It's a world religion that says they're intermediary beings, and they're part of the essential understanding of reality. It's in the Quran. There's a surah about them. Don't believe in the jinn, don't believe in these in-between beings, you're not actually a Muslim, you're an infidel. So anyway, you're squirming and slithering, I'm just joking, to get away from defining imagination, the imaginal realm, made me think of how Ibn Arabi said that this is a realm of the jinn, so don't trust everything. All right, Tom, now I'm going to try to nail you a little bit, because I'm going to ask you a question I'm asked all the time. Is it just my imagination? Am I just making this up? I mean, there's a tendency, talking in English, to dismiss the imagination as the producer of fantasy and personal, you know, wishes and so on, and not something that has any enduring, I'm trying not to say objective, because in a sense it's all subjective, not something that has any foundational value. How can you speak of imagination as something that has distinct value, even as a great faculty of the soul, as it's been called in Western tradition?
So here I will anchor myself in Corbin, and that will help. So for Corbin, and he's following Ibn Arabi and his other masters, but I don't really know them directly. I know Corbin, so I'll stick with Henri Corbin. And for Corbin, there's a distinction to be made between fantasy and true imagination. Because within us we have the unconjoined imagination, I think is what the term is. Or maybe it's the other way around, it's conjoined to us. But there are two ways in which imagination tends to manifest in us. And one belongs more or less to us. And that's the realm, he says, of daydreams and fantasy and things that are not really trustworthy. But beyond that, and partly because of that, is the true imagination, and that descends from above. one of the problems that's a little difficult depending upon who your exact audience is that this can seem so outlandish that people rebel against it. I certainly did at first. Because Corbin is saying, in total distinction from how I was raised, and most people that I'm familiar with were raised, ideas and imagination, they don't belong to us. They don't come from us. They're not produced by us. We are receivers of them, and the true imagination and real ideas descend from above. So in the Western tradition, it's very Platonic. And insofar as medieval Christianity was Platonic, this mirrors that. And so true imagination is the sort that Muhammad would have gotten when he was told by the angel Gabriel to recite, you know. And so there is a distinction to be made between true imagination, which descends from above, and the fantasy, which is produced down here by us. Of course, that leaves the very difficult problem of being able to discern the difference between the two. And I'll pause there.
Yeah, we have such different ideas about the self, what it contains and what contains it in different traditions. I mean, like you probably, I tend to be by reflex a Neoplatonist. I dreamed of a teacher who seemed to come from that school when I was a teenager, who told me back then that all knowledge that matters comes through anamnesis, which is a word that we can find commonly amongst the literate today, but as a teenage kid in Australia, I'd never heard until he said it to me. But when we look at the traditions that Corbin is writing about and their context, we come again to questions of discernment. You mentioned the prophets and Jibril and Gabriel. Well, in one of the versions, this is the Hadith, of course, it's an oral narrative. It's not in the Quran, but a lot of understanding of Islam or misunderstanding is based on the supposed sayings of the prophets through the Hadith. So the Hadith says that when Gabriel turned up, the prophet didn't believe him. He thought he might be a jinn. He thought he might be a deceiver. And his first wife, Khadija, who's there, says, well, you check him out. First of all, if you can look at him and he doesn't slip away. Back to slippery. If you can hold a stable image of him, then you'll know that he's for real. So he does this, and he's surreal. And interestingly, in another hadith, when he first sees the prophet, this might be the root of his suspicion. He looks like a beautiful young man who the prophet had admired greatly and thought was the most handsome guy ever. So there's possibly his self-doubting that maybe some element of fantasy or wishful thinking in himself is coming into play. So there are these questions of discernment. Well, let's go to the question of place, where these interesting dramas are played out. And maybe to get you buzzing a little more here, Tom, I'm going to read you something which is in Corbin. Actually, I'm quoting Corbin. I'm quoting Creative Imagination,
in Ibn Arabi, and, but I'm quoting one of Ibn Arabi's disciples, Sadruddin Kunyawi, who was not very well known at the time that Corbin published, but now has a whole research industry looking at him. Anyway, here's the quote. We're going now really to the imaginal realm. We're going to the question of where do we have the significant encounters, the imaginal encounters, the visionary encounters that are for real and are to be trusted. So here's a quote from Sadruddin Kunyawi. Our Sheikh Ibn Arabi had the power to meet the spirit of any prophet or saint departed from this world, either by making him descend to the level of this world and contemplating him in an apparitional body similar to the sensible form of his person, or by making him appear in his dreams, or by unbinding himself from his material body to rise to meet the spirit. So here in this one sentence, we have three modes of direct engagement with greater guides, greater teachers, guardian angels, higher jinn, whatever we're going to call them. You could call them, or Ibn Arabi, as a sheikh, could call, a spiritual leader could call such a teacher to descend to the level of this world and appear in, quote, an apparitional body, which some of us might call a subtle body, similar to the form he would have in the physical world. Him appear in dreams, we're going to come back to that, or by unbinding himself in this material body to rise to meet the spirit. So here we're talking about astral travel, maybe something beyond it, spiritual ascension to a place, to a level of reality that you and I, Tommy, can talk about after the break, what has been called the imaginal realm. We're talking with Tom Cheatham, one of my favorite subjects, which is the reality of the imagination, the reality of the imaginal realm, and some great sources we have for that. This is Way of the Dreamer with Robert Moss. Back after the break.
Where can you find out about dreams and the dream world? MossDreams.com. At MossDreams.com, you can find out about Robert Moss, his work, and discover the way of the dreamer. Read numerous articles and essays on almost every facet of dreams. Find out Robert's class and workshop schedule. Read reviews and so much more. Visit MossDreams.com to find your way of the dreamer. That's MossDreams.com.
Robert Moss has a deep engagement with the dream world, and now you can take a crash course from this master of active dreaming at your own pace. That's right. You can get Robert's 8 exciting half-hour programs on a new DVD set called Way of the Dreamer. Share Robert's story as a dreamer and dream healer. This dynamic 3-DVD set can help teach you how to find your way through your dreams to realize your full potential. Don't wait to learn the practical dreamwork techniques that can help you understand how to attain better health, emotional stability, spiritual awareness, and more. Order Way of the Dreamer DVDs today from Amazon.com or MossDreams.com. That's MossDreams.com.
We're HealthyLife.net, reaching and helping a worldwide audience without hype, without shock, and without shenanigans.
You're listening to The Way of the Dreamer with Robert Moss. Just to confirm that my excellent guest today, Tom Cheatham, is a real scholar and gentleman. He asked me during the break for the page reference for the quote I just gave you, which I appreciate. Having been briefly a professor myself, I'm a stickler about having exact quotes and exact references. And when I can find it amongst the 30-word documents I've got open, Tom, I'm going to send it to you. But I appreciate the question. One of the things I can't stand in our world of social media instant sharing entertainment, people don't do the work. They don't nail things down. They don't research things. I mean, talk about fake news. I mean, the lack of fact-checking and the knowledge that flies back and forth is infuriating to me, as it probably is to you. Anyway, I gave you that quote from a disciple of of Ibn Arabi, who was trained by him in Konya, where there's some very interesting academic conferences going on into all of this, as you probably know. Not an easy place to get to, given the state of politics in the world, but still. But we have that quote about three ways of having direct contact with the guide, the kind of guide you want to talk to, maybe the kind of guide that Sufis beautifully call the soul of the soul. Get the guide to come to you if you can. Meet them in dreams. Get ready for a spiritual ascension. Maybe it begins an astral projection and meet them in another realm. And here we go with the word imaginal realm. I found that extraordinarily helpful when I first came across it, partly because, unlike the French, we don't have a word like l'imaginaire in English. Imagine the imaginary. Yeah. It implies imaginal realm. But the imaginary in English doesn't work. I've seen people try to use it, the imaginary. It doesn't work. We don't have the imaginaire. We can't say that in English. So imaginal realm became for me, as it I think it did for you, a way of usefully and coherently and succinctly describing a realm that is beyond the physical, below the divine realms or spiritual realms, beyond form, and actually a place where you can go. So if you're introducing the word imaginal realm, imaginal world, and you've done it, you wrote a book which discusses both Corbin, Hillman, and Jung, I think it's called Imaginal Worlds, isn't it? What do you say by way of introduction? What do you mean when you say imaginal world or imaginal realm?
So one good way I think of trying to grasp it is to recognize the kind of what Corbin calls organ of perception that is necessary to perceive it. And for Corbin and Ibn Arabi and others, the organ of perception is the heart. And right at the beginning of his book on Ibn Arabi, he makes a link between 20th century phenomenology and the thought of the heart, which is indicative of the kind of breadth of reference that you continually find in Corbin. It would be useful, I think, for readers of Corbin to know that although he talks mostly about these Islamic traditions, he's very clearly trying to bring that sensibility into contact with those parts of the Western tradition with which it shares the most. And he was, in fact, the first French translator of Heidegger, and he did know the Western philosophical tradition and theological tradition exceedingly well. And sometimes that contact between the two traditions is a smooth one. Other times it's a bit of a shock. He says that with the help of phenomenology, we have learned to make use of the intentions implicit in all the acts of consciousness or transconsciousness, and he says, and this is the key, to say that the imagination, or love, or sympathy, induces knowledge of an object which is proper to it, no longer smacks of paradox, which struck me at the time as a sometime student of Heidegger and Husserl. It wasn't the kind of phenomenology that I was familiar with, but the take-home message here is he's saying we have some traditions in Western, certainly in theology, but even in contemporary philosophy that are trying to make this kind of access to knowledge respectable. So then later he will talk about the heart as an organ of perception, And it's that kind of mode of knowing which allows access to the mundus imaginalis. And it's a very particular kind of sensibility that you have to learn very carefully. He says in the prelude to Spiritual Body and Celestial Earth somewhere, and this is an echo of your reference to the Quran and the idea of entering through the open door, he says, the mundus imaginalis cannot be entered by housebreaking. And the mode of knowing of love or sympathy, the mode of knowing with the heart, is precisely not housebreaking. It's that kind of gentle and personal acquaintance with the object of knowledge, and the word object is entirely misleading here, because the kind of knowing that the heart privileges is knowledge of persons. And for Corbin, true knowledge of this Gnostic sort is always knowledge between persons, and it has the intimacy of that kind of contact.
It's all very interesting. Yes, yes, we must go to the place of the heart. But thinking about Ibn Arabi and what you're quoting via Colbert, Ibn Arabi was very interested in the jinn, as I mentioned to you, in the genies, and he is especially interested in a form of the jinn known as Qarin. The Qarin is a spiritual companion or spiritual double, which in Ibn Arabi's mind, not sure how far Colbert gets into this, but in Ibn Arabi's mind, not just his mind, in the mind of whole schools and traditions, with the spiritual double and, according to Al-Ghazali, great theologian of the 12th century, at the moment of birth, the Qarin, our double, our demonic double, our daimonic double, enters the heart, the way air fills an empty bowl. So spiritual practice in life, for Ibn Arabi, based on this and centered on the heart, involves taming the spiritual double who lives in the heart, so that when you listen to the heart, you're not confused by the veils and deceptions it puts up. Just another wing to all of this, because I've been looking at it again recently, and I'm realizing, much as I love Colbert, how much of the Islamic context is left blurry in Colbert? Just as, of course, when we think about history, he talks about Iran as the country the color of heaven, and then a couple of months after his death, we've got the Ayatollah. Anyway, ironies of history. We're talking to Tom Cheatham. He's a very good man, a very good writer, very good philosopher, very good biologist. And like me, he loves the work of Henri Colbert and his efforts to explicate and present a rich Islamic tradition, or Sufi, perennial tradition of the soul, spirit, its wanderings, and its homelands. We'll be back after the break.
Robert Moss has a collection of books, audio, video, and DVD products that will help you bring the creative and healing gift of dreams into your everyday life. Revitalize your work and relationships and journey to the furthest reaches of your imagination. These books are tools that everyone can use to begin or enhance active dreaming in their lives. Visit mossdreams.com. That's mossdreams.com. MOSSDREAMS.com.
Since ancient times, indigenous people from every culture have used their dreams to help interpret their lives, the world around them, and the future. Now you can tap into this indigenous wisdom with Robert Moss's workshops and classes, all designed to help you learn more about you and your connection to the dream world. If you're interested in finding out about how to host a class or workshop in your area, email Robert at robert at mossdreams.com. Or to find out about Robert's ongoing schedule of classes and workshops offered worldwide, visit his website, mossdreams.com. Get your personal dream symbols and discover the ones you dream about in Linda McKenzie's Symbols of You, a new book available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Target, and more.
You're listening to HealthyLife.net, the radio network that brings positive talk with positive change to make your world a little better.
You're listening to Way of the Dream with Robert Noss. My wonderful guest is Tom Cheatham. You can find his website if you look for his name. Cheatham is spelled C-H-E-E-T-H-A-M. Tom, I can't finish the show without talking about dreams. I dreamed my way into all of this. In fact, my dreams have guided my research in most areas. I can say, like Jung, I have thoughts and ideas all day long, but I take up on my work what my dreams give me, both paraphrased to memories, dreams. Reflections. Dreams are quite central in Islamic tradition. They're quite central in the work and writings of Thorawadi and Ibn Arabi. I suspect they're important in the life of Corbin, though I don't remember him actually sharing personal dreams. Do you? Did he write about his own dreams?
No, no, he didn't. And as you're talking here, I'm casting my mind over his work, and with one exception, which I haven't read in a long time. There is one piece that he wrote, probably in the 60s, on the dream in Islamic mysticism, and you make me feel guilty for not having looked at it before our conversation. But with that exception, though he does, it's not that he ignores dreams. I'm sure there are. Yeah, I'm sure in the book on Ibn Arabi he talks about dreams, but it's not. It's interesting. It's not. They don't figure centrally in his game of things, and I wonder, and this is just a question, I wonder if he was without a doubt a very sensitive and even mystical soul. There, but 2 points about that. Almost never spoke of his own personal experiences. There is one exception to that that I'm aware of, and that's in a piece that he wrote when he was 30 years old. He wrote a piece that was later published, I think when he was quite old, called Theology by the Lakeside, it was notes that he wrote down on a trip to Sweden when he was in his early 30s, maybe even not quite 30. And it's a visionary description of the landscape full of angels with his, and he explains his experience with his eyes closed, pretending to sleep, and he recounts what you would call a mystic vision. With that one exception, he never speaks of his personal experience, which is, I think that's for a particular reason. The reason,
right.
Like very, very quickly, being that he thought, you know, his experiences weren't that important to you personally. What was important to you personally was your own experiences. So you would never take his experiences as a guide, because you need your own guide, you know.
Right. Well, we can follow that silence in terms of personal experience across the disciplines back in the period when he was doing his work. I mean, if you go to anthropology, for example, you find many anthropologists who are writing about the dreams, prominently writing about the dreams of the indigenous people they're living among, but never record their own dreams except occasionally, posthumously.
famous one who gave us really marvelous ethnography to some extent of the Creek Indians, and had kept a dream journal, but it took his wife posthumously to publish some of it. And I don't know that it was, you know, the refusal of importance to their own dreams that conditioned this. I think it might have been more, it simply wasn't the form in their day to share direct personal experiences. There are some traditions, of course, and I've talked to proponents of Tibetan Buddhism who've learned this in their training, who have been taught not to tell personal stories for various reasons. Anyway, thank you for that. What was the what's the title of the essay or piece where that story appears?
In English, it's Theology by the Lakeside. The only translation of it that I know is my own. You can find it in the volume titled Henri Corbin, which was published in French. I forget the publisher. And it's in there as Theology au bord du lac.
Oh, okay. Well, I read French as easily as English, and actually I've read most more Sarawadi in French than in English, so that's not a problem. I will look for that. Here are some quotes from your favorite book, or one of your favorite books, for which you asked for page number. I have the page numbers if you need them, too, on the importance of sleep and dreams in all of this. And let me just preface it by saying, I've been writing a piece about the dreams of William Butler Yeats recently. I've known Yeats all my life, too. And he said at one point, despite all the ritual he did, all the seances, all the mediumship, all the magic, he said at one point, you know, his most important source of knowledge on what matters was dreams that were granted, as opposed to dreams that are sought, dreams you ask for, spontaneous dreams, which have been true, by and large, for me most of my life, especially dreams that come in the half-dream state. So here's Ibn Arabi in Corbin's Creative Imagination. The only reason God placed sleep in the animate world was so that everyone might witness the presence of imagination and know that there is another world similar to the sensory world. So here's Ibn Arabi saying the only reason to sleep is so we can dream, and dreaming have access to what we were discussing as the imaginal realm. Like Corbin, you keep calling it the mundus imaginalis. I didn't do that well with Latin in school, Tom, so I'm going to avoid Latin as far as possible. Yeah. But here we are, we're being told that the reason for sleep is so you can dream and, you know, you can go to another world that will look like this world, but it's different. And then when we go on, dreams occur in the transthural state. Well, the word transthural might invite long discussion, but amongst other things, it means travel, it means transporting some part of yourself. Dreams occur in the transthural state when the rational soul visits the treasury of imagination and sees both what the senses have lifted up from what they've acquired from sensory objects and what has been formed by the form-giving faculty, which is one of the assistants of this treasury. So the stuff about what's going on in the imaginal realm is familiar enough, but what to me is delightful, to me as a dreamer is delightful, is being told so explicitly that dreaming is probably or possibly your best mode of access. So certainly Corbin brought us in these versions of Ibn Arabi a tremendous imperative to get on with the dreaming, even if he didn't record his own experiences.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the way that I have read Corbin most usefully is in order to help me attain that liminal space of dreams at the edges of waking life. There, that's, I think, that's part of my reading of Corbin.
Well, thank you for the pleasure of sharing your pleasure and passion in reading Corbin. There are books that can ignite us, aren't there? And sometimes our discovery of such books is mediated by the being that Arthur Koestler called the library angel, or in my experience, by the shelf elves who sort of throw things at you. You go to a used bookstore, there's something on the new arrivals that is exactly what you need for that day. In my house, which is very lively and full of books, of course, the shelf elves will actually throw books off the shelves at me from time to time to get my attention. I think they also hide things. All right, we've been talking to Tom Cheatham. He's author of several books on the imagination and a couple of books on Henri Corbin, the great French explicator of the medieval Sufi philosophers and their visionary experience. We'll be back to say thank you and dream on after the break.
Robert Moss has a collection of books, audio, video, and DVD products that will help you bring the creative and healing gift of dreams into your everyday life. Revitalize your work and relationships and journey to the furthest reaches of your imagination. These books are tools that everyone can use to begin or enhance active dreaming in their lives. Visit mossdreams.com. That's mossdreams.com. MOSSDREAMS.com.
Since ancient times, indigenous people from every culture have used their dreams to help interpret their lives, the world around them, and the future. Now you can tap into this indigenous wisdom with Robert Moss's workshops and classes, all designed to help you learn more about you and your connection to the dream world. If you're interested in finding out about how to host a class or workshop in your area, email Robert at robert@mossdreams.com. Or to find out about Robert's ongoing schedule of classes and workshops offered worldwide, visit his website, mossdreams.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
You're listening to Way of the Dream with Robert Moss, and I just demonstrated how we are magnetic. We attract things through what we think and say. I was talking quite a lot about the jinn, the genies. Some of you probably saw 3,000 Years of Longing, marvelous film based distantly on A.S. Byatt's novella, the jinn in the nightingale's eye, all centering on the famous three wishes. A marvelous, marvelous jinni, Queen of Sheba, whose mother is a jinn, features. Anyway, I've been talking about the jinn. And then I announced that we're at the end of the show. We're not. We've got another 8 minutes. Thank goodness. Another 8 minutes with Tom Cheatham, which will be a blessing. But Tom, the jinn are known to be tricksterish and to play pranks, not necessarily malevolent pranks. I think I just invited the trickster into the show. Probably the trickster was there already. But I think I invited the trickster to sort of make a little bit of a show and flutter its feathers or whatever it's wearing today. That's the kind of thing that happens.
That is super fascinating to me, and I'm going to follow up on it. And the reason for that is that it is quite true that my knowledge of Ibn Arabi comes via Corbin. And so I am very far from a scholar of Ibn Arabi. And you do not find much mention at all of the jinn in Corbin's work. There's probably some, but it's certainly not a main theme. And it helps bridge the gap for me, between Hillman and Corbin, because Hillman is all about the mercurial and the tricksterish, and his take on Corbin's imagination is much more jinn-like than Corbin-like. It's a pretty well-known fact that Corbin, at least by the end of his life, was pretty nervous about what Hillman and his gang were doing with Corbin's idea of the Mundus Imaginalis, and that at least as an elderly man, he was very much afraid that they were going to misuse the Mundus Imaginalis, and I think what he was concerned about was the secularization of the sacred, and I actually think he was being overly sensitive. I don't think myself that Hillman runs particularly that risk. But the bridging concept then becomes the function of the jinn. And then just to steal another minute here, one thing that we've talked about it during the breaks, and perhaps we mentioned it earlier, is that Corbin has been criticized by many scholars of Islam as not a terribly reliable source. Not that there was anything wrong with the hundreds of translations and commentaries that he wrote, but that if you, for instance, relied on Corbin's version of Ibn Arabi as an objective account, you'd miss a lot, and likewise many of his other accounts of Islam. And I think the reason for that is that he himself was a kind of primary source. Corbin's project was not simply to be an accurate and objective scholar of Iranian mysticism. He used it as a transformative tool, and his overall life's work was to show the commonalities among the religions of the book, including, by the way, Zoroastrianism. And so he's really a creative theologian more than merely an objective scholar of any of those religions.
Okay, that's all very helpful. I'm going to give you a book recommendation, Tom, since you like books. Yes, I do. It's a recent book published by SUNY Press, which is one of my publishers, by Dunja Rašić, who's from Belgrade originally. She's currently a researcher at the university in Qum in Iran. The book is called Bedeviled. The subtitle is Jinn, Doppelgangers in Islam and Akbarian Sufism. What is Akbarian Sufism? It's the school of Ibn Arabi Akbar, the great Ibn Arabi. And the whole book is about, really, about Ibn Arabi's teaching and experience about the jinn, including the kind of companion spirit that comes into your heart, which I mentioned when you started talking about operating from the heart. And it's a scholarly book. It's got all the references. And it's out recently. And its particular study is a double or doppelganger called the Qarin, Q-A-R-I-N in Arabic, which is the one of the jinn that is your personal devil, or your personal daimon, or your personal spirit. And I think it's something that you might enjoy looking at in the context of this conversation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. Bedeviled. I've got it.
I like talking to literate people, you know. I like book lovers.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much for that. That's great.
No, you're quite welcome. well, bibliophilia, I like to say, is one of the more harmless vices. I'm not sure. I had to leave one house before it collapsed under the weight of the thousands and thousands of books. Because I sort of have to own them and stroke them in the middle of the night and read them with a pencil at hand. But for some academic texts, you can only really do it online because they're hard to find. Any last thoughts on all of this? Perhaps I should prompt you by thinking about what you said about the role of the philosopher in life. You wrote in your book, The World Turned Inside Out, you wrote this. Now, I think you're quoting Corbin, but I think that you're also speaking for yourself. To be a philosopher is to take to the road, never settling down, in some place of satisfaction with a theory of the world. The adventure is a voyage which progresses towards the light. I love that.
Yes. That's Corban. Yeah. And the one thing I would add is that Corban's best books can be initiatory experiences. And his book on Ibn Arabi surely was for me.
Yeah. I often recommend to people who are new to this that The Man of Light in Sufi tradition?
In Iranian Sufism,
I don't know whether that was an independent book or whether it's a collation, but it's a very useful introduction to Corban's ideas, particularly in terms of getting in touch with the teacher or the self on a higher level. He sometimes seems to approach that in rather a Plotinian sense, you know, approaching the self on a higher level. But as you say, he was a universal scholar, knew Western mystical traditions very deeply. All right, Tom. Well, how the wind has carried us through. The jinn have sped our way. Great sharing so much with you. We'll be back after the break to say thank you and dream on. This is Way of the Dream with Robert Noss, our wonderful guest today. Is Tom Cheatham. You can find him online. Just Google Tom, C-H-E-E-T-H-A-M. Back in a moment.
Since ancient times, indigenous people from every culture have used their dreams to help interpret their lives, the world around them, and the future. Now you can tap into this indigenous wisdom with Robert Moss's workshops and classes, all designed to help you learn more about you and your connection to the dream world. If you're interested in finding out about how to host a class or workshop in your area, email Robert at robert@mossdreams.com. Or to find out about Robert's ongoing schedule of classes and workshops offered worldwide, visit his website, mossdreams.com.
Robert Moss has a collection of books, audio, video, and DVD products that will help you bring the creative and healing gift of dreams into your everyday life. Revitalize your work and relationships and journey to the furthest reaches of your imagination. These books are tools that everyone can use to begin or enhance active dreaming in their lives. Visit mossdreams.com. That's mossdreams.com. MOSSDREAMS.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Tom Cheatham, what a delightful guest you are. Thank you for your passion, for the imagination, for Hillman, for Henri Corbin, and for your own path on the never-ending journey of the philosopher of life.
Thanks for having me. It's delightful.
All right, let's dream on, everybody. May your best dreams come true, and may you remember them.